Hello, everyone. This is your host, Manoj Tandon. Welcome to another episode of Dark Rhino Security, Security Confidential. Today, we have another awesome guest, Dr. Eric Cole, joining us. And does he have a background? He is absolutely a cybersecurity expert. He's been a hacker with the CIA. He's a best-selling author. He's written 8 books, his latest being Cyber Crisis. He has been on President Obama's Commission for Cybersecurity. In fact, I think he was the commissioner. He has been inducted into the Information Security Hall of Fame. As you can guess, worked with a lot of illustrious organizations from the U.S. Air Force to many Fortune 500 companies. We're honored to have him here. Thank you, Eric, for joining us. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. And thank you for doing what you do and sharing the message of cybersecurity with the world.
We're trying, but it's really folks like you who carry the voice, because nobody really listens to me.
I listen to you, my friend.
But, you know, what one good place, and we always start with this, because there's people always have this curiosity of how did you get started in cyber? All right. Was that your training as your background, or how did you come into this? Please enlighten us.
I was born early 70s. So cybersecurity really became a thing until I sort of became an adult. So I'm getting ready to go to college and going into architecture. And a family friend is like, Eric, why don't you go into computer science? Because everything's going to computers. So if you go into computer science with your analytical mind, you'll have a lot more potential. So this was in the mid to late 80s, and I go to computer science, which once again is really an engineering degree. Yep. And I remember sitting there on a Thursday afternoon in a Fortran programming class going, if this is my future, I don't want it, right? Because I'm like, this is not what I want to do. This is not fun. So for some reason, and I feel like there's always the hand of fate on everyone's life, something told me that afternoon I needed to go to the co-op office. And so I listen. I show up to the co-op office at 4 o'clock. They close at 4:30. And they're like, oh, so you must have heard. And I'm like, heard what? They're like, well, once every 2 years, the CIA recruits on campus. They're coming tomorrow, and we have one slot left. Do you want it? And I'm like, sure. So I show up, and sometimes – when you're naive and you have no idea what's at stake, you end up doing better. So I didn't at the time really understand the impact of the situation. Like, you are interviewing with the Central Intelligence Agency. So I show up and just sort of chill and cool and do my thing. And the next thing I know, one thing leads to another, and they're flying me down to DC, going through the whole background polygraph. And I get an offer to basically work for them. And the office that had the opening, coincidentally, not my choice, was the Office of Security. And I think you could see how that story got us to where we are today. Wow. So it's a lot of these random events that all just sort of lined up to lead me to where I am today.
I would say, cause back then, and I remember those days well, you know, you had to write your own code. And we were, it's Fortran 77 or C, and it was on the VAX platform typically, or these. Probably most of our audience doesn't even know what half that stuff is. It's, you know, it's just, it's so dated and so ancient. But it's interesting that the cybersecurity was a focus even back then, or is there aspects of it for the CIA?
This was in the 90s.
Okay.
Before the World Wide Web, before e-commerce, like before the internet. I mean, even back then, if you, nobody had computers at their house, there wasn't websites or anything along those lines. So what we were really focused on is really just from an operating system, like the operating systems that are on our computers, are they storing information? Are they secure? So it was really more from a much more granular OS standpoint. And remember, floppy disks, there weren't really networks. So it was a completely different time and place. But what I love about it is I was there working in security from 90 to 97. So I basically was like at that forefront of when the web came out, we were right there. When e-commerce, right there. So, I mean, as these technologies were developed, we were right there running across. Now, the only regret I have is I'm like, dude, really? You couldn't have come up with Google or Amazon? Why did I come up with those ideas? Because none of them existed at the time. So it was sort of funny to watch. While today we think Google and Amazon are these brilliant ideas, at the time when they came out, you're like, well, that's stupid. Who's going to buy something off the internet, right? Like when Jeff Bezos started Amazon, believe it or not, it was everybody thought it was a stupid idea because we're like, we have Barnes & Nobles, we have Walmart, we have Home Depot. Why would anyone buy things? You mean you're going to buy something on the internet and have it show up at your front door? It just seemed like such a foreign concept. But that's the idea that I've realized is the brilliant innovators, the people with the brilliant ideas, you're doing things that everyone thinks is crazy. So that's my new test when I come up with an idea. If 20 people don't say it's crazy, then it's not a good enough idea, right? You want the crazy ideas because those are the ones that are revolutionary.
Yeah. And you know what? The interesting thing with that is that even Google and Amazon were copying, and I would say they copied off of Sears Roebuck and Company, because if you turn back the clock, Sears Roebuck was allowed America to buy off a catalog in an era when there was just Main Street USA and there was a general store. And you could buy everything from a house kit to dynamite out of the Sears Roebuck catalog, right? Yeah. And I'm sure people back then said, who the hell is going to order stuff through the mail?
And to me, probably the most amazing thing is the shift in what I call the prioritization of security. So let's just do a quick preview. In the 90s, security was viewed as an option, a nice to have feature.
Yes.
It wasn't viewed as something that we had to have. Like when you went in and presented security features at companies in the 90s, it was viewed like any other feature. What's the benefit? What's the value? What do customers want? Then in 2000 to 2010, 12, we saw the shift where it's like, no, we really need to have security, but it was still a secondary feature. Like it couldn't. It was after functionality and everything else. Then we see if we have a little money for security. But then it's funny to watch now in the last 5 to 7 years, where now security has almost become one of the key core drivers in building any product out there, where consumers, even at some level, ask for it of what is the level of security components. And I know even non-technical people, if they go to websites and there's not two-factor or some of the basic security, they step back and go, is this really a place I want to give my personal information to? Because are they really going to protect it and keep it safe? So it's sort of been interesting to watch that role in public perception of, it's not really needed. We sort of need it. It's a nice to have to, we must have it to keep our information and data safe.
Now, you know, some of that thinking in certain sectors is there, but there's a whole bunch of sectors where they are still having difficulty with spending on that. Like, for example, like if you look at medical devices or in general, OT devices that are out there. The work you did early on at the CIA, where you're looking at memory storage, how data is being accessed, those are foundational principles that would still apply even to those devices that are being developed. And you guys kind of pioneered a lot of things. Why is it that they still don't get that part of it right? Why don't we have secure PLCs? Why don't we have secure pacemakers or things of that nature? Yeah.
Right. So to me, it's real simple. And the reason is this. Cybersecurity is not a technical problem. We think it's a technical problem. And because when security first came out, it involved IT, we automatically put it under that technical category. That's why, to me, one of the biggest mistakes companies still make is putting the CISO under the CIO. I'm like, no, you're getting it all wrong. It's not a technical problem. And here's the issue. With technical problems, you can solve it with money. Because IT is a technical problem, uptime availability. If you want to achieve 99.999% uptime availability, buy more stuff, buy more redundancy, buy more pipes. And if you buy-
I'm loving enough, this, by the way. You are preaching to the choir. Keep going.
Yeah. So if you go in and buy enough stuff, you can solve it. Cybersecurity is not a technical problem. It's a business problem. And business problems can't be solved. They can only be managed. So going back to your question with PLCs and others, it can't be solved. It can be managed. So the question is this. What is the criticality of a PLC? Now, I would argue, just if we can play a little devil's advocate, sure. I would argue PLCs in OT, super secure. If you follow the rules, of making them air-gapped. They were designed and they were built to be on an air-gapped network. That was the security that was built in, because you want a PLC to have simplicity of functionality, simplicity of verification. I want the code to be light and tight so I can verify and validate and know exactly what it's doing. Security adds complexity. Security adds other things to it. So PLCs were built and designed with security in mind of, let's make the code so light we can verify and validate. And the security premises, these are going to be on an isolated air gap network connected to reactors or other critical devices with no outside connectivity at all. And I would argue for 20 years, they were secure. They were super solid. You didn't see any issues or any problems. Issue. Somebody decided to change the rules. Somebody decided to say, let's take these PLCs and let's put them on a public network. Let's make them accessible to the internet. And that is never, ever what they were designed to be built for. So I would argue that, hey, if you want PLCs connected to the internet, which, by the way, to me is insanity, but if that's what you want, then great. We need to redesign the whole model.
Well,
but
you know,
PLCs are secure. We're just not following the rules.
And the devil's advocacy here, again, what people would say is, we've gained operational efficiencies because now we know how to deal with big data. There's patterns that are available to us in that data from those PLCs that have made great strides in operational efficiency. And if you totally shut it off, then we won't get that real-time monitoring and real-time ability to variate the process as it's continuing.
Is that true? Is that really true, or is that a good... Because I will tell you, I've
said that
with...
Personally, that's really true. I don't. I think okay. You could still do that in an air-gapped environment, but you wouldn't... It would be inconvenient to show that data to outside people. It would be harder to do it.
Right.
It wouldn't be readily available.
Right. So this is great case study. So let's run with it back to my statement where cybersecurity is not a technical problem. It's a business problem, and business problems can't be solved. They can only be managed. So here's what we do with our customers, because I have a lot of customers in this space. I ask them two simple questions. What is the value and benefit of connecting it to the internet? And you just named some. Operational efficiencies, ease of access, all that stuff. Awesome. Pile it up. Then... Now give me in this hand, I realize my camera's small, so I have to move my hands together. So in this hand, let's cover all the risks and all the exposures. Everything you're putting at risk, the impact to the company and negativity. So now I have these two piles. Now I ask you a simple question. It's a really simple question. Does the value and benefit outweigh the risk? Are you willing to accept these risks to your business in order to obtain these values and benefits? And the reality is, in most cases, when you present it correctly, when you present both sides of the story, I would say 85% of the time, they make the right decision and go, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. But here's the problem. We're not basing our decisions on complete data. We're only taking the one list of value and benefit and going, oh, look at all these values and benefits, we should do it. But they never stack it up against the risk and exposure. And that's the failure. Because I'll tell you what, if you do that, if you come back to me and go, Eric, I understand the value and benefit. I understand the risks, and we're willing to accept the risk. The value and benefit is so great. I'm willing to accept all these risks. That's awesome. But I don't know a single company that actually does that. And that's the failure, where they're basing decisions on incomplete data.
Okay. So we're going to put a pin in that, because there's several questions that... are going to come out of that. But playing devil's advocate again, in that argument where in one hand you're putting all the benefits and in the other you're putting the risks, there will be those that will say, especially let's look at critical infrastructure. If you look at air-gapped environments, look what we did to Iran with Operation Nitro Zeus. That was a completely air-gapped environment, right? We still penetrated it, not through the internet, but with USB drives that spun those centrifuges out of control, right? So it, and it was pure human behavior, leaving a fancy USB stick, sticks at various watering holes around the facility in the hopes, well, you work for the CIA, you know human behavior, that someone was going to pick that up and they're going to plug it in to something that they shouldn't plug it into, which is exactly what happened. Yep. Right.
Yeah.
And at that point it was game over. So the argument would be that if I am a critical infrastructure, if I am PG&E or I don't want to pick on them for any reason. But if you're a large electric operator or a big water utility or something that's super critical, they're like, well, if a nation state really wants in, they're going to get in anyways. And in the meantime, I've given up the benefits of operational efficiency. And what would be the counter response to that, Eric?
So you're saying it's okay to drive drunk. I might not get into an accident, but if I'm driving drunk, I greatly increase the probability of doing it. So you're saying, Eric, because even if I drive sober, even if I do air gaps and I do everything I'm supposed to, I could still get compromised. Even though that could still happen, why even bother put any security in place? We might as well just, since we're going to get compromised, we might as well make it as easy and as simple for the attacker as possibly can. So because I know I'm going to get into an accident anyway, why not just drive drunk and the heck with it, right? So to me, that's not really the valid argument of saying because 100% security doesn't exist, we shouldn't try. We shouldn't even put measures in place. But I just so you know, I'm teeing you up because we talked about this before the show. So what we're really talking about is the focus shouldn't be on the prevention. The focus needs to be on the detection.
There you go. And that brings us, you couldn't have done it any better.
How is that for the transition?
It was actually brilliant. It was, and we did talk about this before the, which brings us to a former affiliation you had with the Air Force, and they did this study and they coined the term the prevention paradox, in which their claim was the more you focus on prevention, the less secure you become. Your thoughts? Give us a little feedback on that notion.
Yeah,
it's kind of.
Yeah, I think it's spot on. And the reason is this: we need to recognize that in any reasonable sense of the word, 100% security doesn't exist.
That's right.
I joke, yeah, I guess we could take a system, bury it in the ground, fill it with cement, and maybe we could say it's 100% secure, but it has zero value. So the law of cybersecurity is whenever you add functionality, you decrease security. Whenever you add functionality, you increase risk. So we need to recognize that attacks are going to happen. What one of my big mottos is embrace the breach, right? People are so terrified. Oh my God, what if we have a breach? Yeah, you're gonna have a breach. So don't be afraid of it, embrace it. But the whole issue is if you focus all your energy and effort on prevention, and I think this was the point you were making, you can restrict the system to the point where it's paralyzing, where nobody can work and nobody can do anything. Like we use your example where we air gap. So it makes the job harder. But, oh, Eric, they did USBs. Great. So let's block USBs. And you get to the point where you're paralyzing the environment with so much prevention that nothing can get done. So the concept, and a lot of people came up with it with different terms, but yeah, like you said, the Air Force, the prevention paradox, the concept is this, wait a second. The goal of security, what is the goal? The goal of security has never been to prevent all attacks. It has never been to stop all attacks. It's never been to be 100% safe. The goal of cybersecurity is timely detection and response. The goal of cybersecurity is to control and minimize the damage. It's not to prevent all attacks, because guess what? Preventing all attacks is fool's gold.
That's right.
It can't be done. So to me, it gets to the problem is, and this is where good CISOs become world-class, where they educate their executives that the goal is not to stop all attacks. I'm the best CISO on the planet, and if you hire me, you're going to get compromised. But what I will promise you is it won't be for 5 years, and you won't be paying $10 million in ransom. Right? We're going to catch it early. We're going to contain it. We're going to control it. We're going to minimize the damage. You might have 50 records stolen. You won't have 500 million. So that's the whole claim, that security professionals that are best in their class are focused on how do we create an environment that allows functionality, but detects and controls damage in a timely manner. And for a lot of world-class security engineers, it's so foreign to them because they want to secure the heck out of the system.
That's right. Eric, I don't know of too many CISOs who have the cojones to actually make the statement you just made, right? That would actually go to their boards and say, you know, I'm not going to stop all the breaches. I can't. If you hire me, I won't stop all of them. And they'd be like, well, I just won't get hired then. Or a lot of them, believe it or not, think it's a short term. Look at the duration of a CISO. You know, how it's not exactly a position you retire from in most organizations.
But why though? Because as soon as a breach happens, what is the playbook for every company? The playbook for almost every company is if a breach happens, the CISO failed because they were supposed to prevent every attack, and therefore we fire the CISO.
That's right. So someone's always the fall guy.
Yeah. So if you're knowingly taking a CISO job where you know the executives believe prevention is the only solution, and if there's a breach, you're going to get fired, you basically have a self-imposed death sentence. You've been given a terminal illness where you know for a fact you're going to be fired. You just don't know if it's 3, 6, 9, or 12 months. Now, the problem is there's such a demand for CISOs that if you've had a CISO title, you're almost guaranteed to get another job, that most of them don't care. But that's the problem is CISOs, they're not willing to have those hard conversations because they know they're going to get fired, but they know they're employable. But to me, for cybersecurity to get to a level of maturity that it needs to, we need to start owning the reality that we have to have the conversations that breaches will happen. And the criteria for security has to be on how quick did we detect and how timely did we control the damage, and not on binary, did we have a breach or not?
And, you know, first of all, you're 1,000% correct, but it also gets back to, in a lot of instances, there's an inherent conflict of interest in most organizations because the CISOs is reporting into the CIO. And now you've got, you know, in a sense, the wolf guarding the hen house kind of a situation, right? It's, you need to break that function out completely. And it has to be independent to be able to give an honest opinion without repercussions on bonuses, on promotions, on all the other nonsense that people regard, I shouldn't say nonsense, but things that people consider as being super valuable in their career moves, right?
And I even go a step further where it's not separated out, it's flippant. And what I mean by that is, what is the definition of cybersecurity? The definition of cybersecurity is understand, manage, and mitigate risk of your critical assets to disclosure, alteration, or denial of access. What is IT? Availability. IT is denial of access. So IT is one of three areas of cybersecurity. So if we really wanted to do it correctly, your CIO reports to the CISO. Your chief risk officer reports to the CISO. Your chief data privacy officer reports to the CISO. And then your CISO is one of the top five executives. So you have your CEO, your COO, your CFO, your CISO, and your chief legal officer. Those are the five that should be running a company. The problem is companies are so confused. They go in and they take the CISO. They bury him under the CIO. Then they create a chief risk officer that actually is a parallel to the CIO. And then they create a chief data privacy officer that they bury under legal. And it's like, are we really trying to make this as confusing and difficult as it possibly can be? Because it sure looks like it. Right? They're just trying to just do these throw in the darts, and nobody ever steps back and say, how should we do this in the most logical way possible? And there's a really simple solution, but nobody is ever stopping for long enough to actually let rational decisions drive the organizational structure.
But Eric, the solution you propose is such a paradigm shift. That word would apply, because you look at this typical CISO, they are typically not business people in a lot of instances, and they've come from technical backgrounds, or they're regarded as being technical people, or that's the CIO has the big boy chair, right? And I won't argue it, but I think that would be a paradigm shift. It's a great idea. I think it's a fantastic idea. I love it when people want to rearrange the chessboard. If you don't like the way it's set up, just change it.
But I would argue, look at the data. Aren't we in need of a paradigm shift?
Yeah.
I would do it work. Why aren't organizations saying, listen, what we're doing is not working. Why don't we do a paradigm shift and mix things up to try to find a solution that does work?
It would take a CEO with some serious cojones to pull that off. Now, I'm sure there's some out there that are fairly avant-garde that might listen to this. And if they do, and we see a change, we will highlight it. I think it's a great idea. What you're bringing up are foundational issues about managing cybersecurity, managing risk, yep. Not 100% security. And that, I want our audience to understand that. That is foundational and fundamental to what you're saying. And that's so important to get, if you're going to get cyber right. If you're going to do it. There's an argument, and I've heard this, not from a lot of companies, but I've certainly heard it from companies that, you know, why are we responsible for cyber? Why is the government not responsible for it? Just like when the airlines were responsible for security, we know what a horrible job they did, and they all complained, and now we have the TSA, right? Why is that same parallel thought not true in the world of cybersecurity? Because in their minds, a lot of the bad actors are state-sponsored groups. They're like, well, as a business, we can't compete with that. You know, so why is this not a government responsibility? Why is this being pinned on us to spend all this money?
So to me, a couple of ways to look at that. First and foremost is you can have the safest car on the planet, but if you put an unsafe driver in the seat, they can still get into an accident.
Yeah.
So ultimately, it's the driver of the car that's responsible for the security of the car, not the people who make the car. Now, I don't let anybody off the hook because I start off talking and I joke. When I get done talking, I piss everybody off because I blame them all. So that's not saying that the manufacturers of software and hardware shouldn't make it more secure, but I'm saying companies also have a responsibility for implementing it correctly. But then I'll also caution those, be careful of what you ask for. Do you really want the government telling you and dictating what level of security you should have within your organization and holding you legally and liably responsible for that? Now, I think because companies, many have been asleep at the wheel, I think it's going to come to that, but I don't think it's going to be as pretty as everybody wants, because if you study and know how Washington, D.C. does things, how Congress and the White House passes laws, it's not in the best interest of the people that are affected by it. It's what's in the best interest of the people writing and passing the law. So I'll tell you, when it gets to that point, which it will if we continue down this road of companies not taking the responsibility, it's not going to be the prettiest thing on the planet. But the government at some point is going to have to jump in and start regulating at some level if companies don't start taking that ownership for protecting and securing their information.
So what was your advice to the president when you were in that role on how to tackle this problem, or some policy directives?
I mean, to me, that it was more on national security measures. So it was more on how do we protect the nation as a whole to implement better security and protection measures, not more focused on individual companies. But my whole premise was, and it's talking about paradigm shift. I think that's my middle name. My parents just didn't know it when they named me. But look at the internet today.
Okay.
The core backbone of the internet is run by the United States. And this might or might not shock you, but it's a question I've been asking for 10 years and nobody can answer. Give me a list of all the connection points the United States has to the internet. Because if most of the attacks are coming from Russia or China or other areas, why don't we just block those? And the answer is we can't, because we are the internet. Like, we cannot answer that. I will tell you, I do work for Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
They can answer that question. They have a list of all their connections to the internet, and they do a great job of blocking different traffic. When you're in Saudi Arabia, there are certain sites you cannot access. They are blocked at a national level. They are not blocked at an ISP level. So Russia the same way. It didn't make the news, which shocked me. But last year, Russia actually went in and disconnected from the internet for 48 hours.
Really?
Yeah, just to show that they could, and they could isolate, and they did it as an operational readiness for the overall country and military, that if there was if I believe we're in a cyber war, but if there was a more overt cyber war and they needed to protect their country, they could do that. Most countries can. The United States cannot, because the internet and the backbone of the United States are exactly the same. So to me, what I believe the government should have done, instead of spending trillions of dollars during COVID on God knows what, they should have spent, you know, I mean, that money on basically redesigning and separating out the backbone of the internet from the US connectivity to the internet. So this way we're like every other country, where we can control and manage the traffic that flows in and out to our borders. We have amazing border patrol physically.
Right.
We have zero border patrol when it comes cyber. Yet cyber is where more damage and more attacks are coming from. Why is that? So that was really when I worked on with the White House and other commissions, that's really my whole soapbox that I'm on, is we need to start isolating, segmenting, and designing the internet correctly. So there's a backbone, and then there's countries that connect to it. But right now, every other country is independent, but the United States and the backbone are one and the same.
Isn't there an advantage as well, though? On the one hand, that's a weakness. On the other, because we are the backbone and everyone is cycling through it, we have visibility to all the stuff that's going on. So in terms of learning other people's capabilities, methods, tactics, techniques, procedures, what they're up to, what they're thinking, what they're not thinking, we have a lot of visibility to that. Or I would assume the folks at the CIA and NSA do, at least.
So I hear you in theory, but in reality, there's a couple of problems. One, all the traffic is encrypted, so we really can't see it anymore. And two, no, internal to internal country communication doesn't go across the backbone of the internet. Right? It's only inter-country communication. And then the other problem is, it's so much traffic that's controlled by independent private entities that we really don't have the visibility that you think we would have. So I would argue there's perceived benefits, but based on the dismantled way it's organized, we don't actually take advantage of any of those benefits.
Okay, that, I learned something new today. I always thought that with the immense computational capability that the NSA has developed and their ability to pick out voices just off of cell phone calls, certainly tracking somebody across the web would be well within their capability to do at their discretion, if they so chose to do it.
Because I like to stay alive, we'll just, what's the next question?
Okay, I like that.
Well, you know, I want to keep you alive too, my friend.
I think by virtue of the so many podcasts where these kinds of topics have come up, I'm sure they're listening in on my wire. That's good for them, you know. Do you want to know what a little cybersecurity company's up to? Rock and roll, man. Help us out. You know, so you know, getting back to, there's this balance between technology, understanding business-specific risk, understanding of process gaps, and understanding of human behavior. If you think of it, I always think that these are five elements that you need to kind of bring together into some kind of cohesive structure if you're going to build a real cybersecurity program. How do you do that? That's a lot. If you think about it, the CISO would be like human behavior. What do I have to do with that? You know, understanding gaps in process. Well, I'm just tech. You know, I can tell you how our firewalls are set up. I can tell you how we do two-factor. But do they understand the way they conduct business? Might be creating process gaps that are allowing unintended visibility.
I agree with you completely. The way I would sort of summarize it is sort of two things. One is simplicity is the name of the game. If you look at most of these breaches, most of these issues, most of these problems, and I say most, not all, I just want to be clear here because there's always exceptions to the rule. But if we focus on the word most and not all, most of these problems are created by functionality that is not really needed or used. We love making things overly complicated. We love chasing new crazy features and functionality when we don't use that. Look at the average person. I love doing this when I do live events. I'll ask for a volunteer.
Okay.
And I'll say, give me your cell phone. And they'll give me their cell phone. And I'll proceed to count how many apps they have on their phone. Page after page after page. And it's like, on average, people have hundreds of apps. I then go under usage. And in most cases, if you're looking at monthly, just 30 days, they've only used 3% of the apps on their phone. Yet every single one of those apps is code that is running, functionality that is enabled, and potential exposures and vulnerabilities on their system. Why? Because it was easy, because it was free, because those are habits that we've developed that are really, really bad. But the reality is, if we just went in and simplified most devices, we only put functionality you need, not that you want or desire, but that you only need, and we remove all the extra stuff, a lot of these vulnerabilities start to go away very, very quickly. And so that's one theme. The other theme that we have to recognize, I joke that world-class CISOs minored in psychology, because you got to understand human nature. Human nature is simple.
Right.
Nobody likes having things taken away from them. But if they don't know they're being taken away and they're not using it, then nobody cares.
That's right.
I will tell you that this is a trick I use with client after client, and I've experimented with it. What is the number one method on why systems are compromised? Attachments and embedded links in email.
Yeah.
Number one. And if we need to narrow it down, today it's all embedded links. People are getting these scams, these spams from all these places. You think it's from legitimate shipping services, e-commerce, your bank. You click on the link, it compromises your system. So I used to go in and socialize. Hey, starting next week, we're going to block all embedded links. We're going to basically take them out, and you have to go to the legitimate site. We're not going to allow it. Well, you would think I was going in and murdering people. You can't do that. Like, they were going nuts. They were revolting. They were going crazy. I mean, I would be in boardrooms and the vice presidents, you can't do that. You're taking away our rights. You're prohibited. I mean, people go nuts. So then I had this amazing idea. I just did it and didn't tell anybody. And guess what happened? Nothing.
Nothing.
Nobody noticed. Nobody cared. And nobody did anything. Now, I'm not saying you bypass your executive team. So when I'm a VCISO, I tell the executives, they're fully aware of what we're doing. I say, trust me, if you want to simplify security, spend less money and be more secure, here's how we do it. We're just going to go in and covertly, for any external untrusted sites, we're just going to disable and remove embedded links. They're just not going to be there in the email. No choice, no option, no nothing. And nothing, nobody will notice. And what happens is you do it, and all of a sudden, the incidents, the breaches, the compromises drop significantly, and nobody complains. Nobody notices and nobody does anything. So the name of the game is do your research, find the functionality that's creating the biggest exposures. And I would bet 9 times out of 10, nobody's even using them or care about them. And if you remove them and simplify, that's one of the best ways to secure your organization with minimal to no impact.
That's brilliant. That was worth the price of entry. Yeah. Which was free, by the way.
But if you're charging, I'm going to start charging you, man.
But you know what? Well, let's get to something that you do get to charge for. Let's briefly talk about your book, Cyber Crisis. What's the driver behind it? What's your message there?
So the driver behind all my books is always to solve a problem that's not there. So a couple of years ago, I'm sitting there with some executives. And they're like, Eric, we need a simple business book written in English that executives can understand. Quick read it on an airplane, read it in a week. You know, I mean, simple language, but just to understand and explain the basic concepts of cybersecurity, like piece of cake. I said, book has to exist. I said, I'll research, I'll find the book for you and I'll tell you about it. I started buying all these books with these titles that look good. And they were all technical books with business titles. And I'm like, there was no good book that in 2 hours could explain the principles and concepts of cybersecurity to a business person. So what I do best is I solve the problem. So that's why I wrote Cyber Crisis as a high-level, quick overview read so business executives can quickly understand and know the questions they need to ask so they can make the decisions that positively impact security in their environment. Because here's the reality. Executives are concerned about security. It is one of their top priorities, but nobody ever trained them.
Yeah.
Nobody ever taught them. And most CISOs are technical. So your CISO comes in speaking techie. Your exec has no clue what they're saying. They have no idea what to ask. And you have this disconnect that creates friction. What I tried to do with Cyber Crisis is minimize the friction so everybody can speak the same language.
That's wonderful. And it's a much needed item. I can just say that. Everything you've said there is true. And a lot of executives they completely don't understand it. And they don't know what the questions to ask are. And that's foundational. We're at the hour. I want to make sure we give you at least a minute to plug anything you want to plug. So please, the floor is yours. Is there anything you want to let our audience know about? Whatever it is.
I mean, the big thing I want to plug is, even though I have services that I charge for and all those things, to me, if you want those, you can find them on your own. What I want to plug is my job is to share knowledge and information and to make the world a safer place. I believe my purpose is to secure cyberspace. So I urge you, follow me online on one of the social media platforms at Dr. Eric Cole, DrEricCole. I go live every day. I put a lot of this free content out there. There's no charge. I don't upsell because I want to make the world a safer place. And the way we do that is through exactly what my friend is doing with this podcast, by educating people. So I would love to keep being your mentor and your guide for free. So follow me on social media where I have a lot of free content so we can continue to make cyberspace a safe place to live, work, and raise a family.
Eric, that's a wonderfully noble cause, and we're grateful for you doing it. And we would love to have you back, because I think we've only scratched the surface, and maybe we will get in trouble with certain agencies next time you're on. But
and thank you for saying that, because to me, that's the ultimate compliment. Being asked to come on a show once, great. When you're asked to come back again, that's the ultimate compliment. So thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much, Eric.